Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee Podcast. In this episode, Melissa Rogers discusses religious expression in American public life as part of the annual Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Melissa Rogers is the director of the Center for Religion and Public Affairs at the Wake Forest University School of Divinity. She is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Rogers gave this presentation in 2011 on the campus of Georgetown College in Georgetown, Kentucky.
It's indeed a high honor to have been invited to give the 2011 Sheridan Lectures. Now, you'll notice that if you look across that program, that I have selected a few issues that are very non-controversial. They don't arouse deep emotions. They don't provoke sharp differences of opinion. Okay, I'm kidding. No, we're going to keep it interesting over the next day or so, and we're going to, as Buddy Sheridan would say, handle some hot potatoes. And our first hot potato will be religious expression in American public life. Now, given my topic, I can't resist beginning my talk with a story about the debate over the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. As you know, our pledge says we are one nation under God, and the constitutionality of the pledge and its recitation in our public schools has been challenged. But you may not know that a well-known constitutional scholar, Robin Williams, has a brilliant solution for this controversy. He has said, why don't they change the pledge so that instead of saying one nation under God, it says one nation under Canada. So that way everyone will be happy. Well, seriously though, these are important and controversial issues, and I am going to get our conversation started, and then I want to turn to you to hear about your thoughts and views on the issues, whether you agree with me or differ from me. Well, this afternoon, what I'd like to do is discuss some of what the United States Supreme Court has said about religious expression in American public life. And then I'll offer some of my reflections about the best ways to keep faith free from governmental control and why that freedom is so important. So let's begin with the words of the First Amendment. As you know, it states in part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech. That first clause is what we call the Establishment Clause. It prohibits the government from promoting religion. It also prohibits the government from denigrating religion. It performs both of those functions. The second clause is the Free Exercise Clause. Put simply, the Free Exercise Clause protects people's, individuals, and groups' abilities to express their faith as they see fit, rather than as the government sees fit. And the third clause is the Free Speech Clause, which protects individuals and groups' abilities to speak without governmental interference, including the ability to speak about religious matters. Well, how has the Supreme Court applied these three clauses to cases involving religious expression? Here's one important guidepost. The court has said there is a crucial difference between government speech endorsing religion, which the Establishment Clause forbids, and non-governmental speech endorsing religion, which the Free Exercise and Free Speech Clauses protect. So, government speech endorsing religion is prohibited. Non-governmental speech endorsing religion is protected, and doubly so, by both the Free Speech Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Now, notice that the court does not draw the line about what is constitutional and what is not constitutional based on where the speech occurs. In other words, it doesn't say that if the religious speech occurs on government property, then it's unconstitutional, and if the religious speech occurs on non-governmental property, then it's constitutional. No, the key question under constitutional standards is to whom the speech is attributable, the government or non-governmental groups and individuals, not where the speech takes place. So our constitutional standard captures the common sense truth that when a Muslim girl wears a headscarf to public school, or a Jewish boy wears a yarmulke to public school, or a Christian girl wears a cross necklace to school. It is abundantly clear that these are expressions of personal faith, not those of the government. Now, contrast this with the approach of a country like France. Many of you probably recall that in 2004, France adopted a ban on wearing what it called conspicuous religious symbols to public schools. While this ban was largely thought to have been aimed at Muslim girls wearing the headscarf, it also covers Jewish yarmulkes and large Christian crosses. So France, in contrast to the United States, finds the location in these instances to be determinative about whether it's permitted. If the religious expression would be visible in this public school setting, then it is forbidden. French officials believe religious symbols must be removed from the public square to preserve the neutrality of the public square so that no group feels excluded. France, in other words, suppresses these religious differences in an effort to create unity. In contrast, the United States allows these differences to be expressed in public life and locates our unity in the rights of free expression and free exercise of all people. A very important distinction. Well, under these rules, what are some specific forms of public religious expression that the Supreme Court has upheld? And here I'm using the phrase public religious expression to mean religious expression that's visible in to the general public, not behind closed doors of houses of worship or homes. And by the way, if you'll permit me here, I'd like to insert a brief infomercial. This is a document that the Wake Forest University Divinity School Center on Religion and Public Affairs produced last year with the help of Holly and Bren and Jeff and many others that answers many questions about what the Supreme Court has said about religious expression in American public life. And I call this to your attention because I will be referencing some things that this document says, but also because you can access this document on the web after the talk if you'd like more information about this topic. So what has the Supreme Court said about religious expression? Let's start with non-governmental property and spheres. Well, of course, we have churches that have property that their building rests upon. Churches can put up crosses or nativity scenes. Synagogues can put up Stars of David. Mosques can put up crescents or other symbols. Non-governmental property can be used for all this kind of religious speech that is visible to people generally in the public. In fact, I've seen many in the setting of homes and houses of worship. I've often seen signs with scriptures in the yards of church houses and indeed in homes, the front yard, just as a way of proclaiming a person's faith in the public square. The Supreme Court has also recognized that individuals and groups may publish their religious views in books and newspapers and websites that they produce, and that they can ask other newspapers and websites and publishing houses to publish views that contain religious themes. Religious organizations have the same right as other non-governmental organizations to seek radio and TV licenses. And of course, we're accustomed to listening to many of those programs as we drive in our cars or flip through the channels at home. Also, in non-governmental workplaces, if an employer permits discussion of secular personal interest, then the employer must also allow the discussion of personal religious interests as a general matter. For example, if a car dealership has a cooler and they allow people to come together at the cooler and talk about their hobbies and what they did over the weekend, people can talk about the worship services they attend over the weekend just as they would talk about something else that they did over the weekend. Well, what about religious expression on government property and in other spheres where government plays a strong role? The Supreme Court has made it clear that there is a role for religious expression on government property in policymaking and politics. For example, the court has held that public school teachers cannot lead their classrooms in prayer or Bible readings. We all remember those 1960 prayer and Bible reading decisions. But it also has said that the Constitution protects the rights of public school students to say prayers over their lunch and to read sacred scriptures at school. public school students actually have many other opportunities to express their faith as well, including the general right to express their religious beliefs in artwork and homework and the like, and the right, generally speaking, to distribute religious literature to schoolmates, just as schoolmates would distribute secular, non-school-related literature. The Supreme Court also has generally embraced a broad equal access policy that applies to public secondary schools. And in this case, it says that student clubs that are Bible clubs or other kinds of religious clubs can meet on school campuses in the same way that other non-curriculum clubs meet on school campuses during non-instructional time. So if they're chess clubs at the local high school, then certainly there can be a Bible club at the local high school as well that meets on school property during non-instructional time. And this equal access concept is actually something that the Supreme Court has applied even more broadly. It has said that when a community, when a government would open its property to community groups generally, then it must open its property to community religious groups on the same basis. So sometimes, I'm sure you may be familiar with the fact that congregations will use public school property on the weekends to meet for services for a period of time, perhaps while they're waiting for a new building to be built for their purposes. And so they will make use of this equal access policy that applies to government property. The court has also held that citizens have the right to temporarily erect a cross in a city park if other symbols were permitted to be erected in this way, and if it was otherwise clear that the display was not something that the government endorsed. So this equal access model, let's take a little closer look at it before we move on. Under the equal access model, the speech that may be religious, and that's of course what we're talking about tonight, occurs on government property, but it's not part of any government program or activity. It is solely the speech of the non-governmental groups and individuals. Government often makes this crystal clear by saying it doesn't endorse any of the speech of the groups that meet on government property. It's just making its property available for community use. The government also doesn't use its power to coerce people to be captive audiences for this speech, including religious speech. It just lets people set up meetings, and it draws, the meetings will draw whom it will draw. No, in the equal access situation, the government simply makes its property available for religious groups to use. It does not then involve the religious speech in a government program or activity. And that, in turn, means that the religious speech that occurs under this equal access model is free from governmental regulation, control, and influence. And people are completely free to listen to it or not, to come or not, as they wish. Well, what about religion's role in policy and politics? The Supreme Court has said that religious people and organizations clearly have the same constitutional rights as secular organizations and leaders to participate in the debate of public issues. Every day, religious leaders and organizations take positions on a range of public matters, including federal and state budgets, the environment, sanctity of life issues, the size and role of government, healthcare, war and peace, and criminal justice, just to name a few. This activity is protected by the First Amendment. The court has also made it clear that the Constitution protects the rights of all Americans to hold public office, regardless of their faith or lack thereof. In this lecture, I'm going to call all of the kinds of religious expression that I've just described as examples of the equal access model, because all involve non-governmental groups and individuals expressing their faith essentially on the same basis as others would express non-religious ideas, and the government simply provides the property in many cases for them to do so and allows that speech to occur. But there's some other kind of public religious expression that the court has upheld, and I need to discuss that with you now, a few wrinkles in the case law, if you will. Those wrinkles involve the government in upholding official prayers before legislative bodies and certain governmental displays that contain some religious elements. Again, these are wrinkles in the case law. They don't follow that broad rule that I gave you at the very beginning. But the court essentially has said there's some exceptions here. We're going to make a few exceptions. They haven't said that in so many words, but that's about what it amounts to. In 1983, for example, the Supreme Court upheld a state legislature's practice of opening each legislative session with a non-sectarian prayer, led by a chaplain paid with public funds. And the court said that it was going to uphold this practice in large part because of the long history of this practice dating back to some of the early days of our nation. The court has also upheld certain governmental holiday displays that had some religious elements in them, when the displays taken as a whole didn't appear to be an endorsement of religion. For example, in 1984, the court upheld a display by the city of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, that contained, and I'm quoting here, many of the figures and decorations traditionally associated with Christmas, including, among other things, a Santa Claus house, a reindeer pulling Santa's sleigh, candy striped poles, a Christmas tree, carolers, cutout figures representing such characters as a clown, an elephant, and a teddy bear, hundreds of colored lights, a large banner that reads Season's Greetings, and a nativity scene. By the way, this case became known in some circles as the one that established the two plastic reindeer rule. And the general thought was, well, while the government may not display a nativity scene by itself, if it sticks two plastic reindeer on either side, then it's probably okay. And by the narrowest of margins, in 2005, the court upheld one governmental display of Ten Commandments and struck down another. And I imagine many of you are familiar with these cases because one of them came out of Kentucky. Now, taken together, I can't say that these decisions, or even taken apart, were a model of clarity. But the court based its judgments in these cases mostly on how long the displays had been there, whether they were surrounded by other secular objects, and the ostensible purpose for governmental action in establishing the displays. Now, I also want to tell you the story that before these cases were decided, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was still on the court, and we were speculating, many of us, about how she might vote, thinking that she was often the swing vote, and so how would she cast her votes in these cases? And we also were aware that sometimes she liked to sort of split the difference in cases. So I appreciated Yale Law Professor Jack Balkin's prediction on the Ten Commandments cases. He predicted that Justice O'Connor would strike down five of the commandments and uphold the other five commandments. Well, he didn't say which five were which, and of course he ended up being wrong about that. Well, in this lecture, I'm going to call this kind of religious expression that is in public life the civil religion model. Here, the government is involved in promoting and shaping speech that has some religious elements. However, for one reason or another, the court has found that the government isn't violating the Constitution when it does so in these cases. Well, now let's turn the corner. Against this backdrop, what are some of the best ways to keep faith free from governmental control, and why is this freedom so important? I'm going to offer a few of my views and then welcome your response and your thoughts in just a moment. In my view, the court's decisions barring the government from meddling in religion have kept faith free. For example, when public schools direct or sponsor prayers, the government trespasses into a sacred realm, writing and selecting the prayers, using the power of the state to assemble a captive audience of young students to hear these prayers. In such cases, faith becomes less rather than more free. Also, when the court has recognized that non-governmental religious expression may occur in the public square, it has kept faith free. I believe the court has wisely said here that the crucial distinction is not where the speech takes place, but to whom the speech is attributable. And here I'm referring back to that example about a Jewish boy wearing a yarmulke to public school, for example. Indeed, given the extensive size of government in modern times, a rule that prohibited all religious expression on government property or in government spheres would deal a very destructive blow to religious liberty. People cannot be expected to limit their religious speech to their homes and houses of worship. Religion informs people's views on a variety of private and public matters, and our national dialogue would be impoverished if we said that religion did not have a vital role in our public life. We've also talked about the fact that the Supreme Court has upheld a variety of forms of public religious expression. And I divided those forms into two rough categories, equal access on one side and civil religion on the other. So Americans who wish to express their faith in public life have some choices to make. They can choose between, for example, urging the court to follow the civil religion model and erect displays, for example, with some religious symbols and scripture, or they can take advantage of the government's equal access model. I vote strongly for the equal access approach and for Americans who wish to speak of their religion in public life to take advantage of that equal access approach. I believe that model does a much better job of keeping faith free. Let me explain. When the government is given power to select certain religious scriptures or symbols for posting or display, it gains a degree of control over religion. It will exercise that control in ways that best advance governmental interests, not spiritual interests, and that will warp religion's witness. When the government displays sacred scriptures, for example, it chooses the text and it describes the meaning of that text, at least to some extent. So we have, as we noted earlier, many cases in which the government has displayed the Ten Commandments, chosen the Ten Commandments for display. Of course, the Ten Commandments are assuredly revered scripture for Christians. But why should they always be posted rather than the Beatitudes or other sayings of Jesus? Perhaps that stuff about blessing the meek and the peacemakers is a bit off message. And the command to love our enemies? Well, that just may cause a little bit of tension with the talking points. Or maybe it's just easier to make a secular argument for posting the Ten Commandments because a few of them do parallel civil law. In these Ten Commandments, by the way, one often sees government officials actually trying to argue that the Ten Commandments aren't religious. The Ten Commandments begin, as you remember, "I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven image. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." I don't know about you, but that sounds pretty religious to me. And in a brief that Holly Holman filed in a Ten Commandments case, I thought a very cogent argument was made along these lines as well. She made the point that in defending these displays, the government often plays up the commandments that have parallels in civil law and plays down the ones that don't have any civil law equivalent. So the commandments against killing, committing adultery, and stealing get much more attention and airtime than do the commandments about having no other gods before me and not making a graven image and not taking the Lord's name in vain. And I have to add here, many of you are probably familiar with the Ten Commandments display that Judge Roy Moore put up in Alabama many years ago. And James Dunn, the former executive director of the Baptist Joint Committee at the time, was watching that and watching the way in which that monument almost seemed to be worshipped by some people. And he said, "How strange it is to make a graven image out of scripture that counsels against making graven images." Well, in these cases, when the government becomes involved in faith, it magnifies the parts of tradition that are useful to it, that serve the state's interests, and it ignores the parts that don't. In this way, the religious tradition is distorted. And given the power of the government's bully pulpit, it becomes very difficult for religious groups to reclaim the tradition and to correct distortions. That, in turn, leads to false understandings about the truth religious leaders and communities are trying to convey. That's probably one reason why Baptist preacher John Leland said in the 1800s that the fondness of magistrates to foster Christianity has done it more harm than all the persecutions ever did. Thus, in my view, religious leaders should not demand that the government erect these kind of displays. Instead, they should counsel against them. Similar issues arise with regard to official prayer before legislative sessions. Here, the government exerts some control over the content of the prayers. They must be non-proselytizing and non-sectarian. And these guidelines are understandable given the context, but there's no question that they make faith less free. Indeed, some guidelines for prayer go even farther. The Minnesota legislature, for example, sends a letter to all people who will pray before it, offering them some guidance. It says in part, in preparing, and I'm quoting here, in preparing your prayer, please keep your prayer brief, about a minute in length, and please refrain from addressing political issues before the legislature. There are lots of religious people who believe that many political issues that come before the legislature are also religious issues, issues that matter to people of faith, issues related to poverty, sanctity of life, war and peace, to name a few. To counsel such people to avoid political issues is to counsel them to ignore their faith. Thus, while it is sometimes suggested that we need to get rid of the restrictions on sectarian and proselytizing references in official prayers, this is one illustration of the fact that doing so certainly wouldn't be the end of government control over prayer in this setting. As long as prayer is part of a governmental program or activity, it will be vulnerable to governmental meddling. So here's one alternative or supplement to think about when we're talking about official legislative prayer this alternative or supplement fits the equal access model. Religious leaders who feel called to pray with legislators could reserve space in legislative buildings before sessions and invite legislators to join them for prayer at that time, just as others reserve rooms for non-official business like corporate lobbying. By doing so, religious people regain control over the religious message. Prayers could be said exactly as these religious leaders see fit, with no restrictions from the state. So I've been talking about some of the reasons that I think that the equal access model is a better one for people who want to express their faith in public life to use than the civil religion model. Another reason I believe the equal access model is preferable to the civil religion model is because it draws a sharper distinction between governmental and non-governmental speech and thus is less apt to send the message that some are second-class citizens because of their different faith affiliation or lack thereof. There is no generic faith, after all. When the government includes religious elements in displays or messages, it has to pick and choose among them. The most politically powerful faith is usually the winner in these sweepstakes. It's a cardinal principle of our nation that people are not second-class Americans because they do not share the faith of the majority. That's a noble principle, and in many ways, it's the secret of America's strength. Let me conclude. The most common fallacy about religious expression in American public life is that the Supreme Court has silenced religion in this sphere. That's false. While we might well disagree about whether the Supreme Court came to the right conclusion in one case or another, clearly its decisions preserve a role for religion in our nation's public life. Another fallacy, in my view, is that governmental speech sponsoring religion or containing religious elements is a highly desirable form of religious expression or religious freedom. I believe this is a serious mistake as well. Faith is most free when it is unencumbered by governmental sponsorship, involvement, and control. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to open the floor for questions, comments. If you'd like to raise a point that was not covered in the talk but is related to it, feel free to do that. What we'll do is I'll just call on you and ask for your comment or question, and then I'll try to repeat that comment or question into the mic so that it's preserved for the video. So feel free to raise your hand, and I will look for you. Yes, Dr. Curry. Okay, the question is about the burning of the Quran in Florida, which I'm sure most of you are aware of happened recently by Terry Jones in Florida. And the question is, well, Dr. Curry correctly said they had the right to do it, but what about it? As you know, the burning of the Quran has been cited in a number of deaths that have resulted in recent days in abroad, and it has been quite a sad and tragic event for many of us to watch. I do agree with you that that there is a First Amendment right to engage in these kinds of activities, and the best response that we can make is to engage people who would do these things as best we can and to counsel them against doing that, despite their liberty to do so, and to present other speech that would both condemn that act as being an irresponsible one, irresponsibility in the extreme, I would say, and to send a message to our neighbors around the world who are of the Muslim faith and at home as well, that we believe as Christians in the golden rule to treat our neighbors as we would like to be treated, and we would not feel very loved by our neighbors if our neighbors were burning our sacred text, and we would pledge to do so with respect to their text. Others, questions or comments? Yes?
Would you expand a little bit on the president's faith-based initiative, what they can and can't do, maybe has done?
Absolutely. And now I get to insert another infomercial for a lecture tomorrow, where if you like this stuff, I'll talk about it at more length tomorrow afternoon. But yeah, it was a privilege to serve on President Obama's Advisory Council for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. That's what the question was about what's happening with that, what can the government do and not do in that area. And as I'll describe tomorrow, there has been some evolution in Supreme Court doctrine on government funding and religious institutions and activities over the last couple of decades. We've gone from a standard that was pretty tough on government funding for religious institutions and activities to one that is much more relaxed when it comes to allowing the government to fund secular programs that would be run by religious entities. And of course, that's what this program involves, government funding in some cases for religious entities that would provide secular programs like welfare to work programs or Head Start programs and the like. Because that law has changed, the rules have changed to some degree. And when President Obama brought us together as the Advisory Council, one of the things he charged us with was strengthening the constitutional and legal footing of those partnerships, because he felt that there had been some deficiencies in the relationship between church and state that were threatening not only the government's integrity, but religion's integrity. And so he brought us in to propose a bunch of reforms to that system, and we have proposed some of those reforms, and he has adopted many of those reforms. One of them, for example, that we did propose and that he adopted said that the rules have to be much clearer about what the government can pay for and not pay for. It should not be able, religious organizations should not be able to use government grant money to pay for activities that involve religious instruction and worship. And that has to be made crystal clear. Because my experience is most of the religious groups that do this work, like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Services in America, they want to play by the rules, but they need to have very clear guidance, practical examples of how they would do that and how they would keep their money straight and how they would respect all these rules. So right now the administration is engaged in a series of efforts that will develop guidance for religious providers and say, if you receive government funds, you must ensure that government grant money is not used to pay for any religious activity, and that those religious activities are cleanly separated from the government-funded program and purely voluntary for beneficiaries, because no beneficiary, simply because they want to receive federally funded benefits, should have to participate in a religious worship program or instructional program. So that's one example of some reforms that we've made that I hope do help to clarify and to benefit everyone involved, the beneficiaries, the religious organizations, and the government. But as I said, we'll get into that much more specifically tomorrow. It is a complex area and one where I believe some reforms still need to be made that have not yet been made. So we'll talk about both the reforms that have been made and the ones that I believe should be made but haven't yet been made. Thank you for the question. Yeah.
What are some express their religion in public schools?
Absolutely, great question. What are some ways that children who attend public schools can express their faith in public schools? And sometimes the way I approach this question is to say that the only religious expression that the court has prohibited in public schools is the kind that the public school directs or sponsors. Everything else is protected, essentially speaking. So let me put some more specifics on that. School children can say grace over their lunches. They could say grace with their fellow students if those fellow students want to join in. They can meet before school at what is sometimes called a See You at the Poll event, and they meet with children of like faith and pray before the school day gets started. They can meet at their lockers for prayer between classes as long as they're not blocking the hallways. Now, they can't, you know, when the teacher calls on them to solve a geometry problem, they can't go down in prayer at that moment. That's they may want to pray for guidance and for, you know, clarity on getting to that geometry answer, but silently, but they can't use it as a way to disrupt classroom activities. But they can, if they are asked to write about a personal experience that changed the way they thought about the world, they can write about a personal religious experience that changed the way they thought about the world. And the teacher would have to grade that assignment based on, you know, secular criteria. Was it well written? Was it, did it follow the rules of grammar? Did it express its ideas with clarity? And was it a good story from start to finish? So those are some of the ways that they can express themselves. Also, I mentioned that the Equal Access Law, which is a federal law, protects the ability of religious clubs to meet on public school secondary campuses on the same basis as any non-curriculum club would meet on public school campuses during non-instructional time. So there really are a wealth of ways in which public school students can express their faith in public schools. They can also hand out, generally speaking, religious literature on the same basis as they would hand out other non-school related literature, subject to, you know, the school's control over, you know, the crowds and when this kind of distribution is done. If you're interested in getting chapter and verse on that, one thing I would recommend is some of the last questions and answers in this little booklet, which is on the web, provide links to a bunch of publications that talk specifically about all these rights. So you can link from this publication to all the other publications that talk about the rights to express one's religion in public school, and that will provide you with chapter and verse on all those issues. And by the way, this booklet and the public school booklets, one of the advantages of them, or I should say, what is in this booklet is very important, but also who drafted this booklet is very important, because this booklet describes current law, and it was drafted not only by my partners, Holly, Jeff, and Brent at the Baptist Joint Committee, but also a very diverse group of lawyers who pay attention to church-state issues, and I'll give you an idea about the diversity. We had everyone from a former staffer of Americans United, of the ACLU, all the way over to a staffer for Pat Robertson's American Center for Law and Justice, who worked together, and I'm not telling you it was easy, but we worked together to draft this document because we wanted to say to people, we can't all agree on what the law should be. We're fighting that out at the Supreme Court. But we can agree in many instances on what the law is today. And it's in everyone's interest to help people understand what current law is today. Then, if you're trying to get it changed, you can say, look, this is wrong. It ought to change. Or if you like the way it is, say, look, it's great the way it is. Leave it alone. So we had an incredibly diverse group, and one of the things that that does is helps people to know that if they rely on, you know, provisions in these documents, they're likely not to get sued if they're a public school district, because the people that would sue them are actually all in agreement on it. And families can know that, okay, this is safe ground. I can be confident about my students' ability to express their faith in public school. And if there's some question from the public school, I can take these publications to the public school and say, contact some of these attorneys who were involved in the drafting of this document, and let's get this matter straightened out. So that's one of the, I hope, one of the helpful features of these documents. Other questions, comments? Yes, Kay Sheridan.
Do churches have the right to campaign for specific people or political parties in there?
I'm so glad you raised that, because that is a legal matter, but not a First Amendment matter. Churches and other houses of worship, let me repeat the question, sorry. Do churches and other houses of worship have the ability to campaign on behalf of a candidate for elective office? And what I was beginning to say was that this is a legal matter, but not a constitutional matter in its particulars. Let me explain that. The First Amendment, as I said, protects the right of religious institutions to, if they want to, intervene in campaigns, if that's what the church decides to do. But there's a wrinkle here, and it comes out of the tax code, interestingly, not the First Amendment. The tax code says, churches, if you want to be a 501c3 tax-exempt entity, which means you have these great tax benefits in terms of the deductibility of the gifts that are given to you and your tax exemption generally, then there's some quid pro quos there. We're going to give you that favorable tax treatment, says the government, but in return, one of the things we say that you cannot do is intervene in campaigns for elected public office, because we're not giving you the tax breaks to be a political action committee. If you want to do that, then don't take the tax benefits and just do it without that benefit from the government. So churches take that tax benefit, and generally speaking, so they are bound by that quid pro quo arrangement. But if they decided that being involved in a campaign was very important to them, then they could say, I'm not taking the tax benefits and I'm going to get involved in that way. Of course, the legal analysis is only one part of this. There's also the analysis of ethically and theologically. Would this be a good idea for our church? A friend of mine always reminds me, you know, he says, well, just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's a good idea. and, you know, so thinking through the kind of freedoms that we have and as church bodies, would that bring greater glory to God? Would that further our mission or not? And that's a decision that each house of worship can engage in. I saw another hand back there, yeah?
Government religious speech.
Right.
President Obama recently gave a speech or a sermon in Tucson. Don't want to pick on President Obama as just a recent example of this
right.
genre I know of. had at least two biblical quotes, a lot of religious liberty, and quotes of the prayer of God. How do you analyze
right. I'm so glad that you asked that question, because that was a part of my lecture that I wanted to get to and couldn't quite with wanting to keep it short. Yes, so the question is about presidents and high governmental officials, high elected officials, making reference to religious ideas, their religious views, in speeches and the like. And we're very accustomed to this when we think about it. The questioner asked about President Obama's speech at the Tucson Memorial, but we can also think, for example, of President Bush's speech at a memorial service right after the 9/11 attacks. We can easily recall references of President Clinton, Carter, and Reagan to religious ideas and religious views. Now, the court hasn't specifically confronted this issue, but some of the justices have in their writings that were tangential to the point they were making in the case. But they have said essentially that we recognize that presidents and other high elected officials are not when they're speaking in those kinds of talks, they're not just giving us the governmental message. They are also individuals, members of the polity, members of our nation who have views, experiences, journeys, beliefs, and identifications. And Justice John Paul Stevens actually wrote this. He said, when we hear them speak, we recognize that part of it is a governmental message, to be sure, but they also retain an individual capacity in which they can express individual ideas and individual background, history, and views. And that is constitutionally appropriate. So certainly in inaugural addresses and all these other occasions, we're very conscious of allowing presidents some of this leeway to express their personal beliefs, including their personal religious beliefs. Now, one can imagine that that could be abused at times, but also one can think about how flat a president's speeches would be if the president, he or she, was not able to reflect some of their personal journey, views, and beliefs and identifications. So I think that's an appropriate recognition by the court, and that's how it deals with that particular aspect. And to me, that aspect is less troubling than the civil religion model, because it is more about an individual person serving in a high governmental office, reflecting their own views as well as those of government. Yes?
The ACLJ, a lot of people think that ACLJ has crossed over the line of religious proselytizing or promotion, and I just wonder if they've ever been challenged on their I understand they're tax exempt.
Right. Oh, are you thinking about the tax code restrictions? Oh, okay. I am not aware of instances where they, excuse me, let me back up and say the question. The question was about the ACLJ and whether they have crossed the line of tax-exempt status, the restrictions that come along with tax-exempt status. I actually don't know exactly their tax-exempt status, probably some portion of them is a 501c3, but I'm not aware of instances where they have crossed the line or been alleged to have crossed the line. I guess I would have to ask you more specifically, because I do know a number of lawyers there who would tend to be very careful about making sure that they don't cross that line. I do know, and Holly, correct me if I'm wrong here, that I think they have been, with some other groups, have been supportive of some churches who have wanted to challenge the restriction on this tax status. So they've said they have challenged, as a constitutional matter, these tax restrictions that come along with the 501c3 favorable tax status, and said that those restrictions are themselves unconstitutional under the free speech and free exercise clause. They have not been successful. In fact, the DC Federal Appellate Court has considered that argument in the past and shot it down. But I believe they, along with others, ADF, excuse me, that Alliance Defense Fund, it's not been the ACLJ, but rather the Alliance Defense Fund, that has been a part of the groups that have challenged that. But I think that they have been careful in their own activities, while not knowing all the particulars, not to cross that line themselves.
But they do a lot of lobbying.
Well, okay, let's talk about lobbying for a moment. The question was about lobbying. The tax, the rules that come along with the tax status actually treat intervention in campaigns on behalf or against a candidate differently than they treat lobbying. They allow 501c3 organizations to engage in an insubstantial amount of lobbying, whereas they can't do any electioneering, none, zero. But 501c3 tax-exempt groups can engage in an insubstantial amount of lobbying. Now, we could talk, I guess, till your eyes glaze over about exactly how the tax IRS defines insubstantial in different cases. I won't do that to you now. But there is that ability to do a certain amount of lobbying even when you're a 501c3 organization. So I think most groups that are 501c3s and do lobbying try to be very careful about staying below that level where they would cross into substantial lobbying and then jeopardize their tax-exempt status. Yes?
What are some ways that educational institutions like Wake Forest have promoted religious diversity as part of its DNA, but yet retained an explicitly Christian foundation?
Oh, great question. So the question was about how have educational institutions, and I think you're particularly asking about educational institutions that have a traditional affiliation with one particular faith, so how have they made an effort to encourage religious diversity? And it is an important challenge for our university and for many others. I know that our university, one of the things that we do is have an office within the provost's office that specifically focuses on a variety of kinds of diversity, including religious diversity. And one of the things that another thing that Wake Forest has done, we no longer have official ties to any religious body, and we are engaged in hiring chaplains from, or engaging chaplains of a variety of different faiths to serve on campus, to be there for students who aren't Christian, who may be Jewish or Muslim. We have right now a Muslim chaplain at Wake Forest University, as well as Jewish chaplains, Christian chaplains, and they all work together and try to engage the student body, not only in counseling students who are of that faith affiliation, but also in the last year and continuing forward through the next year, certainly, we've launched a number of projects that we're calling interfaith service projects, where people of different faiths and no faith are brought together to build a Habitat for Humanity house or serve at the soup kitchen and to get to know each other through that shared value of serving people in need, and then have a discussion later on about what is it in their ethical tradition or religious tradition that motivates them to serve. And we've tried to open up some conversations across religious lines that might not otherwise happen. So, and right now, since this is appropriate, I'll just go ahead and mention it. President Obama has issued a challenge to college campuses for the next academic year to engage in these kind of service projects across religious lines, across lines of religion and no religion, having people involved from all different faith perspectives and ethical perspectives in community service. And that was something we worked on as an advisory council and now continues on through the White House's efforts. And certainly I think Wake Forest and other schools with traditional links to one faith body have tried very hard in many instances to make diversity something that they consider and discuss on college campuses. Yes, sir.
It seems to me that we're hearing more about the free exercise side of things, particularly in defense of religious groups that want to be publicly aggressive and whose exercise of religion carries a high conversion content. How do we deal with this sort of issue in the light of constitutional?
Okay. So the question is about free exercise and groups that may be engaged in the public sphere or otherwise in very serious efforts to convert people of other faiths or no faiths into their tradition. And the Free Exercise Clause protects that kind of activity, very much so, as an exercise of faith, as a free speech matter as well. And the government generally has to stay clear. However, if efforts by any religious group, for example, would begin to turn violent, turn into intimidation or harassment or violence, then there's a role for the government, certainly with violence. We don't want that, and Free Exercise Clause will not shield anybody's religious practice if that practice is violent in nature. And so there are limits to that liberty. But other than those kinds of limits, We try to make our society very open for groups to try to convert one another. That's part of religious freedom. Sometimes we need discussions that are not legal, but rather ethical about etiquette in those situations, what is appropriate in those situations, but it's certainly in the main something that the Free Exercise Clause protects very strongly. Well, let me thank you so much. These questions have been tremendous, the comments as well, and I'm just really looking forward to tomorrow. I hope that I'll see many of you. I welcome your comments and questions there or in between or on email at another time. Thank you again for this time with you this evening. I look forward to tomorrow.
That was Melissa Rogers speaking on religious expression in American public life on the campus of Georgetown College in Georgetown, Kentucky. The document she mentioned is called Religious Expression in American Public Life, and you can find it online on the website of the Wake Forest University Divinity School's Center for Religion and Public Affairs. This presentation was part of the 2011 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. For more information on the lecture series, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.